Welcome back. And I am sitting in for the great George Norrie, and I'll be back in the air chair again tonight, Saturday night into Sunday morning, with Canada's Edgar Casey, the man with X-ray eyes, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell, and we are going to be conducting a remote viewing experiment. I'll tell you more about that a little bit later. I'm really enjoying this conversation with Catherine Chilgen, the author of Shakespeare Suppressed, Learning Lots. Hope you are too. We'll get back to that in a moment, and we'll open up the phones for questions and comments. I love baseball, and I love ghost stories. So this story caught my eye on the slide carousel at coasttocoastam.com, where webmaster tonight, Sean Latasure, posted that. Thanks, Sean. A Major League Baseball player visiting Milwaukee for a series against the Brewers seemingly had his performance suffer after encountering a ghost at a notoriously haunted hotel. Carlos Martinez of the St. Louis Cardinals was staying at the infamous Pfister Hotel when the spooky sighting occurred. In a post to his Instagram account, the pitcher nervously recounted how a ghost had just appeared in his hotel room and that he was now too afraid to sleep alone. Ah, by the pricking of my thumb, something wicked this way comes. Now, back to the great Shakespeare conspiracy on Coast to Coast AM. Catherine Chilgen stays with us, and we are exploring the Shakespeare authorship question. Catherine, before we dive into the phone calls, the producers, I guess, of the First Folio. This is, I guess, what would you call it? Kind of an anthology of Shakespeare's plays. Why did they feel the, or I know why they felt the need to protect the identity of the actual author, the great author, but why did they feel the need to set up this straw man in the personage of Shakespeare of Stratford? Why didn't they just leave it anonymous?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that if they left it anonymous, then readers would read the plays and get a guess as to who the real author was. But if they put the authorship on the Stratford man, somebody who had no connections to the court or the queen, then you wouldn't find caricatures of highly placed people. Like, for example, Polonius in Hamlet. He's the counselor of the king in Hamlet. And it's long been accepted by historians that this was a lampooning of Lord Burghley, who was next to the queen, the most powerful person in England. So if the Earl of Oxford was known to be the great author, then people subsequently would see this connection, and the family would be embarrassed. But if it were the Stratford man with no known connection, it's not going to be seen. And that, I think that they were trying to cover up his identity for that reason, to decontextualize the plays, people in the plays, and also the sonnets, revelations in Shakespeare's sonnets.
So how did they set up this straw man in the personage of Shakespeare of Stratford? How did they make that connection?
Well, I'm sure that it was through Ben Jonson, who definitely had a part in the First Folio, this collected edition of the Shakespeare plays, because he contributed a few verses into it. Ben Jonson probably knew the Stratford man, because the Stratford man was involved in the theater, and it may have been a bit of a joke, because, you know, here is somebody who has the same name of the most erudite, fascinating writer of the period, and compared with somebody who was basically illiterate. And so they probably knew that, and they say, okay, let's put the authorship on him. But of course, this occurred after the Stratford man had died and the great author had died. And I think it was as simple as that. And I think they invented a face for him. I don't think that image was actually the Stratford man's face, and it certainly wasn't the Earl of Oxford's face. But if you look at that image, it's very odd. And in fact, some people see, if you happen to be looking at that black and white image, beneath the ear are two lines, And it could be conceivable that it's like a mask that you can pull off. Some have seen that.
Interesting, interesting.
And of course, right across the image, Ben Johnson says, "Reader, look not on his picture, but his book." So it's odd. Why even use that picture if you're not supposed to look at it?
Right. More breadcrumbs. And again, these pictures are in the carousel, slide carousel, up at coasttocoastam.com if you want to follow along at home. Carol is on the wild card line in Las Vegas. Carol, good morning, good evening. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, gentlemen and ladies. My husband, Rodney Simard, was a professor at Cal State San Bernardino before he passed away. And he they were doing a summer program for migrant students from Coachella and Imperial Valley. And he was going to, we wound up doing Romeo and Juliet, the balcony scene. And we did it in Reader's Theater where the students, we had eight of them, eight couples. So it came off great. This program had different subjects. And I was just, as happy as I could be that it had all come off. And up walks this advisor to me, and he's got a mother standing there. And he said, "She wants to talk to you. She's afraid her English isn't good enough." And I said, "Good enough." And she said that every other night, her daughter would call home and talk about Carol and the doctor and how we had opened the world to this girl, and she would not have the backbreaking job that her mother and dad had had because the world was open now, and it was because of William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. And that's why I called, because we, it doesn't matter what language you're in, what country you're from. These kids, they just loved what they did, and it came off great. But, it's the plays, no matter who wrote them, they can be used as a teaching tool.
Precisely. And that's what I was saying earlier, Catherine. It changes nothing to my mind, or as you say, it enhances the experience of reading these plays. If we transfer ownership back to the true author, which is, as you say, Edward de Vere's the Earl of Oxford.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it would be magnified, in my opinion.
Well, thanks for that inspiring story, Carol. Thank you so much. Mickey is on the wild card line calling from Queens, New York. Hey, Mickey, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Oh, a little better, thank you. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Nice speaking with you.
Likewise.
And welcome to the author, Catherine. As I was listening to the description of what happened with Shakespeare, of course, I'm a little disappointed, but I made a comparison to my father. My father was also a writer, a journalist, and published 5 books. And at the time that he grew up, after he was a man in the 30s, he worked for the president, or a dictator. And I'm sorry, there's a lot, I'm going to read it to you. There's a lot of envy, snobbery, jealousy, fear, ignorance, politics. Many of these people may have wanted to shut my father, to keep him quiet. But actually, he was almost killed because of his mouth, of his writing. So I'm thinking that maybe that's what happened to this man, that because he did not come from an aristocratic family, they could ignore him. Or that's my strong feeling, that he was discriminated because he was not wealthy or rich or well-known. My mother always warned me, be very careful because your father did not finish college. and people are going to come and attack you because you are. He was an admirer of the dictator. He worked for him. Be very careful. And that's my observation, that the same thing that my father went through, all the envy of all the people. But I'm realizing this tonight. I'm 66, but I'm innocent. So the first time I'm watching that my father, because he was a very serious, very, very honest, a good friend, an honest friend. And there were many people that were not, like in most dictatorships, there's a lot of corruption. And he was not uncorruptible. He wouldn't sell his soul to anybody.
So Mickey, just so I understand, are you saying that maybe William Shakespeare, I mean, these plays were written by that Stratford man, but I'm not quite following. What is your theory then, that they were written by the Stratford man or that they were not?
That they were, and they tried to push him away, like they do to poor, ignorant people or people that don't come from the right family. Although my father was a very dignified man.
Right. But in this case, Mickey, according to the sort of the Shakespeare conspiracy, the opposite was done. If it was written by Edward de Vere, who was a nobleman, he tried to, or at least those around him, I suppose, later in life, tried to make everyone think that it was written by a commoner.
Because when they make fun of him, it was not expected of him to be... Like the same thing in Dominican Republic, people who are in the literature, in the arts, they call them usually bourgeois. They are the
right.
Privileged people,
sure,
that can go to school and take writing or write a book while they should be doing something else.
Okay, so then if I'm understanding you, Mickey, that the idea that we would question that this could have been, these great works could have been written by a commoner, sort of speaks to a certain prejudice. Is that the idea?
Right, yes.
All right. Did you want to respond to that, Catherine?
Well, all I can say is that the Stratford man never claimed to be the great author, and his family never claimed he was a great author. So, and it was only attributed to him after his death. And it was a hoax, really.
Thanks for the call, Mickey. Josie is in Richmond, Virginia. Good morning, good evening, Josie. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Both of you. I have a number of little points that I might... I'm so fascinated by this. I was just in a conversation with somebody who swore that it was a particular woman that wrote the plays. I guess you had to be quiet if you were a woman of intellect. And I don't remember her name, the name of the person she was advocating for. But I had long advocated since, a clairvoyant friend years and years ago had said, oh, there's a vault buried here. We were coming out of the side door of the Bruton Parish Church in Williamsburg, Virginia, which is my old church, my family church. And so she gestured in the direction of where it was buried. I said, well, why don't we just get it and dig it up? Because, a vault that was apparently of... Francis Bacon and the Virginia Company had all these documents in there, supposedly that was going to prove this or that and the other, including who wrote the plays. And so there, lo and behold, by some serendipity, I found out that there was a couple and their children who came out from New Mexico, guided by spirit, to come out and dig for the vault in the Williamsburg churchyard. It was quite a scene at the time, caused quite a stir. They had dug all morning with nobody saying a word to them. When they went broke for lunch, I guess it broke the energy or what have you. But in any case, we have here in Virginia a Virginia flag, which shows a woman with one bared breast and her spear over her head shaking. And it's thus to tyranny. Sick tyrannous, Anyhow, know that Francis Bacon was one of the people that was of the Virginia company. And the Virginia company was about at that period of time sent out here to, you know, make money for the Queen. And so I thought that perhaps, well, there's other little side thing to this, that Francis Bacon was not really his name originally. He was the result of a liaison with Queen Elizabeth when she was in the Tower of London with Lord Dudley. And they had a liaison. She had a child, and that child was Francis Bacon. But with political scenes being what they were, and it was very, very delicate at the time, the lady in waiting, Bacon, the name, took the child as if it were hers instead of the Queen's. And the Queen remained the Virgin Queen because of politics. And that Francis Bacon, who wrote the plays because of politics, had to be very quiet. And also it was a time where, oh gosh, there was John Dee, who had all these very secret way to do secret messages. There was Francis Bacon, who was sent as emissary here and there, I believe, at the time for the Queen. And here was this vault, which we still haven't dug up in the right place. It's supposedly lots of mysteries would be solved when we find this vault.
Josie, however, that's all. That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Catherine, you've already sort of addressed Francis Bacon as one of the possible authors, but did you want to comment about that?
Well, I think it's fascinating about this vault in Williamsburg. I have heard that Oak Island could also contain the original Shakespeare play manuscripts. That's fascinating.
Josie, thank you so much for that. Appreciate it. John is in San Luis Obispo. I love saying that name. San Luis Obispo, California. John, good morning, good evening. Welcome to Coast.
Good morning, Richard. It's always a treat when you're hosting on the weekends. I really enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much. Very kind of you.
Oh, you're welcome. And Catherine, it sounds like a great book, and I'm really enjoying this show. You guys have touched on this earlier, and the last caller touched on it, but I'd kind of like to delve a little bit deeper into it. Could Sir Francis Bacon have been strap-on man because there's two things, not just the Shakespeare plays, but he's also to have been rumored to have written the King James version of the Bible. And King James came in, I think, he was King James VI of Scotland, which is where Freemasonry got a foothold in the British Isles. And he came down to England as James I, and he was an advisor, Bacon was, to the king. And Bacon was a philosopher, a statesman, a scientist, an orator, an author. He was also very into the esoteric and the occult behind the scenes. And he was also played a leading role in establishing the British colonies in America. And America has all kinds of that.
Tell you what, John, we're heading into a break here. Excuse the interruption. Why don't you hold on, and we'll get you to finish up that thought. Sounds like you're going into a very interesting place, and we'll get Catherine to respond to that as well. When we come back, more of your calls for Catherine Chilgen as we explore the Shakespeare conspiracy. Hey, welcome back. Sitting in for George Norrie, and I will be back again tonight, Saturday night into Sunday morning. And Dr. Douglas James Cottrell, he's referred to as the man with X-ray eyes and Canada's Edgar Casey, remote viewer, and we're going to conduct a remote viewing experiment on the program. We'll tell you more about that a little bit later. We've long said that humans generally worry about the wrong asteroids. Tabloids love to publish headlines about potentially hazardous asteroids, a category created by NASA that can be a bit misleading. The truly worrisome rocks are the smaller ones that we aren't tracking. The U.S. National Science and Technology Council knows about this problem, and thankfully, it plans to do something about it, according to a report the council released yesterday. A 2005 congressional mandate stated that NASA would try to keep track of 90% of the near-Earth objects larger than 460 feet or 140 meters, and we're only a third of the way there, reports Quartz. And even then, our existing catalog might be flawed, according to a recent paper, but before something can be tracked, it must be documented. Even then, our existing catalog might be flawed according to a recent paper, but before something can be tracked, it must be documented. And even that effort is behind schedule, according to the new report. So the upshot of all this is America isn't ready to handle a catastrophic asteroid impact, according to this new report. I want to tell you about another George Norrie event. He's returning to Asheville, North Carolina. He's back and better than ever. So be sure to join George on Saturday, August the 25th, as he returns to the beautiful Diana Wortham Theater for an amazing show with special guests, the Rocket Man, David Adair, and ufologist Micah Hanks, discussing Area 51. William Fortsgen, author of The Final Day and One Year After, speaking about solar attacks on our planet and our grid, and Asheville's own paranormal investigator, the great Joshua P. Warren, and special spiritual teacher and psychic medium, Vincent Jenna, plus a live band, audience participation, and a meet and greet following the show. For tickets, call 828-257-4530, 828-257-4530, or go to dwtheater.com. Let me spell theater. It's theatre.com, dwtheater.com. Click the buy tickets button and off you go. Please email danwagnerentertainment@gmail.com for booth space information. All right, back with more of your calls and questions for Catherine Chilgen as we discuss the great Shakespeare conspiracy right here on Coast to Coast AM. Shakespeare Suppressed, The Uncensored Truth About Shakespeare and His Works is the book, and we are discussing the great Shakespeare authorship question with author Catherine Chilgen. And John from San Luis Obispo stays with us over the break, and you wanted to also address the possibility that Sir Francis Bacon was the great author, and you were talking about the possibility that Bacon may have authored the King James version of the Bible. Is that right, John?
Yes, that's a rumor. And just the last point I want to would like to make is it's interesting that two of the most influential writings in British literary history were from that era, the late 1500s to the early 1600s, Shakespeare's plays and the King James version of the Bible. The King James version was written between 1604 and 1611. So if Sir Francis Bacon was Strap-on Man, it would be interesting to see if the Shakespeare plays kind of subsided between those years so he could, I guess, translate the Bible. Because I would find it hard to believe he could do both at the same time.
Interesting point. Catherine, what do you make of that?
Well, there's no sources that Shakespeare used post-1604. I don't think that Bacon wrote the Shakespeare plays. He was not known as a playwright. He did write one mask, which is like a play, but he was not known as a playwright. And also, a few contemporaries seem to imply that Shakespeare was dead. And these citations occurred in between 1605 and 1609, and of course Bacon lived longer than that, much longer than that.
All right, John, thank you for that. There's a portrait of Edward de Vere that you've that we've posted up at coasttocoastam.com, and I have to say, the picture looks suspiciously like Gwyneth Paltrow with a mustache. I'm wondering about the possibility that, I mean, it has been theorized that the author may have been, or the great author may have been Elizabeth the First. I mean, have you? Is there any possibility that that might be the case?
Well, she did write a few poems. It's true, and she translated. She did one or two translations. And she was known to be very, you know, very educated, intelligent woman. But I don't see any evidence that she was writing the plays. She had a lot to do politically and running her country. But it does, the portrait on the cover of my book, sort of does resemble Queen Elizabeth in the sense of the little wisp of hair over the forehead kind of resembles her, how she would wear pearls on her forehead. And also the rose in the ear. The Earl of Oxford, this is a portrait of Oxford. I mean, he was a very avant-garde person and into the latest fashions, and a lot of his fashions, actually, he imported from Europe. He was a bit of a dandy.
Maybe that sort of a Brian Jones of his day, late of the Rolling Stones. All right, maybe that's a bit of a stretch. Okay. Let's say hi. West of the Rockies, Francis is in Seattle. Good morning, Francis. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And this is Francis Bacon, for real.
Your last name is Bacon?
My last name is Bacon. I'm descended from my family, and I'm named after Sir.
How wonderful. Thank you for checking
in. I just want to point out that on the title page of the 1623 folio, I'm looking at my copy right here before me. The double V is very important to Francis Bacon. There are 10 of them on those two pages, which equals 100 in Roman numerals, which is simple cipher for Francis Bacon. In K cipher, VVILL, the very first line above the portrait, Mr. William Shakespeare, comedy, history, tragedies, VVILL adds up to 111. K cipher for Bacon. Mr. Bacon, I am Shakespeare's comedies, histories, and tragedies. He also has his name encoded in essays, civil and moral. Civil is C-I-V-I-L, adds up to 157, which is Fraternity of the Rose Cross, and Francis Bacon was the head of the Fraternity of the Rose Cross. There is no doubt that Francis Bacon is the author of the Shakespeare plays because he encoded his name on the first two pages and several pages subsequent. And he was not the writer of the King James Bible. He was the chief editor. And it was not a translation. It was a paraphrase of two earlier English versions of the Bible. And he merely compared it to the original Greek and Hebrew for accuracy, and he encoded his name in Psalm 46, pardon me.
Fascinating. Well, Sir Francis Bacon, you are quite the cipher. So, Catherine, people just don't want to let this Francis Bacon authorship go.
I'm surprised because, 100 years ago, the tide turned for Francis Bacon. Pretty much the lead candidate has been the Earl of Oxford for almost 100 years. So I'm really surprised that we've had so many Bacon calls.
But what about the fact that these encryptions? What do you make of those? Have you heard of this before?
Yes, I have, and I'm sorry, I don't buy into cryptograms mostly and things like that. So
just coincidence.
I don't have a head for it, but I don't see it. Yeah,
it's just coincidence in your mind.
Perhaps.
All right, let's go to the first-time caller's line. Marion is in New Westminster, British Columbia. Hey, Marion, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, yeah, I actually do believe that Shakespeare is a pen name. I think it's a perfect sort of metaphorical name of, a lot of people have said, shaking the spear against ignorance, and a previous caller said against the sick tyrants. That was really great. I actually believe that he was hiding controversial information in his text, political, spiritual, and scientific. For example, in Romeo and Juliet, there are many references to Copernicanism and a motivation for hiding it. When you read certain quotes out of context, you can read a clear, different message. For example, to prison eyes ne'er look on liberty, vile earth to earth resign, end motion here. Almost sounds like a authoritative decree, like you're going to go to prison, people with telescopic eyes or perceptive eyes. Vile earth needs to resign back to its stationary position, needs to end motion here. And there are a lot of other references in Romeo and Juliet which kind of bespeak the true original preface title, which was called an excellent and conceited tragedy rather than a lamentable tragedy. And in Romeo and Juliet, it actually, he defines a conceit, which is more rich in matter than in words. It brags of substance, not ornament. There are lots of references to hidden things in Romeo and Juliet, and it is ultimately a Copernican conceit. And so I think the key to the authorship question lies in decoding the information that lies within, because then you can determine what sort of intellects fueled it. In my mind, it was like sort of like Lucasfilms. It was a production company. There was a head editor and lots of contributors. So anyway,
fascinating. You're a very learned person, Marion. Thank you. That's fascinating. What do you make of that, Catherine? Are there messages encrypted in the texts?
Well, I mean, I would agree with her that there are the great author was aware of the latest scientific discoveries and things like that, and he reflected it in the works. But as far as decoding a message, I can't comment.
Now, the Stratford man was Catholic, I believe, correct?
He didn't go. I believe he was listed as a recusant, meaning he didn't go to Church of England. So I don't know 100% if he was a Catholic.
Right. I'm just wondering if there may be some clues there. I mean, are there, given that Edward de Vere was sort of, a member of the Elizabethan court, and she's the head of, the Church of England, are there any clues as to, is there sort of any anti-Catholic tone in Shakespeare's plays that you can identify?
I don't think so. In fact, some scholars think he, actually had Catholic leanings. And, of course, the Earl of Oxford confessed to have been converted to Catholicism before the Queen.
That couldn't have gone down well.
No. And he shortly thereafter was sent to the Tower. But that was actually for impregnating one of the ladies of honor for the Queen Elizabeth, the lady attendants.
He was a bit of a rounder, was he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right, let's say hi to Tom in the Bronx. Hey, Tom, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Yes, I'm pleased to be on your program, and I'd like to... I'd like to say to your guest that I find it very intriguing. All these years we thought that this individual is one person. Obviously, it's more than one that's contributed to this, to these stories, and poetry and all. So I think that this lady here has a... even though there may have been a movie made about the story, that she should put the facts together again, and they should make a new movie on the subject. I think she's got a lot more to add to it than the previous movie. What do you think?
I would agree with you. I mean, I think Catherine is just an absolute font of knowledge in this regard. Catherine, any plans to be involved in any sort of television production or film production on this subject?
No, but I certainly think he's worthy of like a 50-part series of the life of the Earl of Oxford. It really would be absolutely fascinating.
All right, Tom, thank you for that. Did the Earl of Oxford have any dealings with John Dee, who is sort of the original 007 in Queen Elizabeth's court?
Yes, he did, in fact. John Dee named him as one of his patrons in 1570. And it could be because one of the people who accused the Earl of Oxford of being a Catholic also said that the Earl of Oxford was involved in trying to summon up spirits, and that could have been influenced by John Dee.
Sure, he He was certainly very much into the occult. And was John Dee Prospero in Shakespeare's play?
I don't know. I don't know. But I think that he was more the Earl of Oxford or the great author, sort of in exile on his own island.
No, I'm wondering if he used John Dee as sort of the template for the character Prospero.
It's possible. It's possible.
Stacy, we can work Stacy in Fort Collins, Colorado. Good morning, Stacy. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, I had to call. I'm up much later than usual, so I hope I can articulate this point well. I believe that Shakespeare is who he says he is, and I think he was writing during a very interesting point in history in England. He was a persecuted Catholic, and I'm someone who attends the traditional Latin Mass. And so when I read the plays, I can definitely, there's a devout Catholic sensibility there, and there are many, many references to the Mass and to the sacraments. And somebody who was in the Protestant movement during that time would not have had an affection for these things. His plays are very tortured. They really articulate the divide in his country and the divide that was caused by religious persecution. His father was partly proven that he was part of the underground Catholic Church. They believed that his father actually was one of the people that was moving priests around to say the Mass for Catholics because it was forbidden. So especially, you know, she even your guest had referenced the canopy. And for Catholics, when they do a procession for the Blessed Sacrament, they carry a canopy over the Blessed Sacrament. So there, I mean, a lot of the references that she was quoting are very Catholic, and they had to sneak their children out of England to get them educated as Catholics over on the, in Europe, and especially, you know, Italy. So there were all of these references to Italy, and being a stranger, a foreigner in those lands, in his place, that was a theme that you see over and over again. The last time I saw The Tempest, the closing scene or the soliloquy from Prospero, he's begging for people to pray for him when he dies, which is a very Catholic sentiment. And then
But that wouldn't rule out Edward de Vere, because he did confess to Queen Elizabeth I that he was a Catholic, according to Catherine. Catherine, let me just get you give you the last word on this before we move along.
Well, it was written about the Earl of Oxford after his death that he was magnanimous, generous, and pious. So I see no problem with having Catholic leanings.
And what about the Stratford man's father being involved in the underground church? We'll have to leave that for another time. Listen, this has been a delight. Thank you so much for hanging out for 2 hours with us, Catherine.
Pleasure.
Sly and the Family Stone, Family Affair, taking us into the break, and open lines on the other side. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie, right here on Coast to Coast AM.